in moderation around the election cycle, about making sure their ads are not placed up against white nationalists or disinformation. And Musk has not made good on the promises he's made to them. And so while we've been pressuring and pushing, I've never had such an experience, and I've run a lot of these campaigns, where advertisers are very clear that they're not getting what they need, and we don't have to do the type of pushing. I will say, just to pick up of what Nora was saying, is self-regulated companies are unregulated companies. And while we are doing this advertiser campaign, while we are pushing from the outside, the technology that has so much potential to move us into the future is dragging us into the past. And that is not unfortunate like a car accident. That is unjust, and it's manufactured through a whole set of choices that our government has made about how companies are regulated. Make no mistake, our cars are not safe because of the benevolence of the auto industry. They are safe because of the infrastructure and accountability that surrounds it, because there are people that evaluate and hold accountable. And right now, whether it's the sort of algorithms that are not transparent, whether it's the business models decisions, whether it's these companies getting to decide what the standard is in terms of moderation, in terms of accountability, whether it's the fact that of laws that exist, they have a level of immunity to liability. We need a new set of engagement from Congress and the White House, because we can't keep going to billionaires begging them to protect our civil rights.
Rashad Robinson, president of Color of Change, Nora Benavides with Free Press. We thank you both for being with us.
Portland.
A date which will live in infamy.
Tune in to KABU on election night, Tuesday, November 8th at 6 p.m. for our live midterm election coverage. We'll have coverage that counts from local, county, state, and national races. Our anchors will be with you while the vote tallies come in, and we'll also feature analysis from your favorite KABU hosts. That's KABU's live midterm election coverage, starting at 6 p.m. on Tuesday, November 8th. Don't miss it.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KABU Evening News.
Coming up on the KABU Evening News, we're in the home stretch of the midterm election and the costliest Oregon governor's race we've ever had. Speaking of election records, Oregon has reached a new milestone with registered voters. And on the international front, nations of the world are meeting in Egypt to once again address climate change. Good evening. This is the KABU Evening News from Monday, November 7th, 2022. I'm Michelle Coppola. Well, this is it, the last day before Election Day, and voters have until 8 p.m. on Tuesday to get their ballots into a drop box or postmarked. In the final stretch of the campaign, the governor's race is still extremely close. Polling from Emerson College shows 44% of voters preferring Democrat Tina Kotek, while 40% prefer the Republican Christine Drazen. Independent candidate Betsy Johnson is preferred by 8% of voters. 6% remain undecided. Spencer Kimball is the executive director of Emerson College Polling. Kimball said, quote, Kotek holds a 14-point lead among Oregon women voters, whereas Drazen holds a 9-point lead among Vail voters. In a state where the voting population is nearly evenly split, Kotek's larger base of women voters could win her the plurality of support, end quote. The money continues to roll in for these candidates, with Drazen reporting another $1.25 million from the Republican Governors Association. Kotek received $250,000 herself from the Democratic Governors Association. This makes the race the costliest governor race Oregon has ever had, with spending topping $60 million. The initial results of the election will be posted at 8 p.m. on Tuesday. This is the first year that Oregonians can postmark their ballot on Election Day, so close races like the governor's race may not be determined on the night of the election. While we're talking about election records, Oregon has reached a new milestone by having 3 million registered voters. Voter registration has steadily increased since the state passed the Oregon Motor Voter Law back in 2016. That law automatically registered eligible Oregon citizens applying for or renewing a driver's license as voters. Vote by mail and automatic voter registration are among the innovations leading Oregon to being ranked as the easiest state in which to cast a ballot. As of Friday night, the Secretary of State's office said 29% of registered voters had voted. Oregon elections officials are fielding a higher than usual volume of calls about election integrity, specifically how votes are counted. There are concerns that tabulation systems are vulnerable to hacking, including the possibility they could be programmed to deliver false results. Misinformation around elections started when former President Donald Trump lost his re-election bid in 2020 and began to falsely claim that American elections are riddled with fraud. Concerns appear to be on the rise, however. County officials say there are numerous safeguards that ensure ballot counting machines in Oregon are accurate. For example, they're not connected to the internet or any network that can be hacked, and officials run multiple internal and public tests before an election. Washington County runs some 4,500 ballots through each of its six tabulating machines, approximately 1 month before Election Day. Some of those test ballots are blank, and some are filled out to test a variety of voting patterns, such as if someone marks more than one choice for a single contest or doesn't fill out any choice. During the public tests, which are required by state law, community members can watch officials run test ballots through counting machines and see them analyze the results to verify accuracy. Comparing public tests before any ballots are tabulated and another one at the certification deadline allows officials to demonstrate that the machines have been working correctly for the whole election. Elections officials also run audits after an election, testing the accuracy of a small number of ballots. Drop boxes and county elections offices will stop accepting hand-delivered ballots Tuesday at 8 p.m. Mailed ballots also must be postmarked by that time. The gun violence detection company ShotSpotter has spent considerable time and effort to control the narrative around Portland's potential adoption of the technology. That's according to new reporting from Oregon Public Broadcasting. Portland plans to use that technology to launch a pilot program, but it's unclear when and how much it will cost. Recent studies have called into question just how accurate the listening technology is and if it actually uses police time more efficiently. OPB obtained emails of ShotSpotter's Western director communicating with the mayor's office and supplying them with 7 pages of talking points. OPB reports this is consistent with the company's aggressive sales tactics in other cities as well. They were responding to critical reporting from local sources that highlighted the concerns of community members about adopting ShotSpotter. Eric Tegadoff has more on the community skepticism of that technology.
A police oversight group has formally recommended that Portland adopt a technology known as ShotSpotter to help tackle gun violence. But the technology has been met with some skepticism. ShotSpotter uses artificial intelligence with data collected from hidden microphones to determine the location of gunshots and inform the police department. Dan Hahn is a strategy consultant in government and civic technology based in Portland. He says the technology still has to make some leaps to determine if the sound it heard is a gunshot.
The thing about technology that we really need to understand is that it's not magical, it's not necessarily more reliable, it's not necessarily going to 100% always classify sounds in exactly the right way.
A study last year from Chicago, where ShotSpotter has been implemented, found it led to more than 40,000 dead-end police deployments over less than 2 years. The Focus Intervention Task Force Community Oversight Group submitted its recommendations to Mayor Ted Wheeler and the City Council on Monday. Hahn says if the technology is adopted, open data is key to ensure accountability. JMHE, with the organization Freedom to Thrive, points out the technology is still experimental and has even faced a challenge to its constitutionality as sole evidence in an Ohio case. One of the biggest criticisms is that it could lead to more policing in communities of color. Amechi thinks the resources that would be used to bring ShotSpotter to Portland should be used instead to improve lives in communities of color.
They instead use it to manipulate people into manufacturing consent for the surveillance system that puts more police into their neighborhoods. And we've seen already that more police in neighborhoods does not make us safer. It makes us actually more at risk of police violence.
A ShotSpotter spokesperson says communities affected by gun violence deserve a rapid police response, which gunshot detection enables regardless of race or geographic location. At a community meeting last week, ShotSpotter stressed that the technology would only be used to detect gunshots. But Chris Bushick, who heads the group PDX Privacy, believes the microphones could be used for other purposes.
I really want to believe them, but I've been disappointed many times by tech companies that have broken their promises. And there have been at least two criminal trials where prosecutors have tried to introduce into evidence voice recordings that were obtained from gunshot detection systems.
More than 120 cities are contracted with ShotSpotter, according to the company's website. For Oregon News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
A new study from Oregon State University shows that pollution from traffic congestion has a measurable effect on pregnant people and their babies who live close by. Researchers found lower birth weights for babies whose parents lived close to major roadways where traffic was severe. Their research was primarily based in Texas, where they measured traffic congestion by looking at the concentration of cell phone data. When there were more cell phones clustered for a longer period of time, that meant more traffic congestion and more pollution. OSU professor Perry Heistad is a co-author of that study. Heistad told KGW, quote, "We specifically looked at full-term birth weights, which is how big babies are when they're born. We found that this additional impact of congestion was about 10% of what the impact of smoking during pregnancy is." It's not just about birth weights either, since babies can grow up to face other health risks. The study also estimates broadly that 27% of pregnancies in the U.S. are affected by gridlock-intensified pollution. The report's authors recommend making changes to transportation infrastructure to help parents and babies. They mention sound walls, zoning, and vegetation barriers, all as potential mitigators, but that the issue must be dealt with at a local level. Heavy hitters go on the campaign trail the last weekend before Election Day, and the FBI investigates a suspicious white powder sent to an Arizona Republican. With those stories and more, it's Mary Sherman with 2022 Talks.
Welcome to 2022 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
The only way to save democracy is if we, together, fight for it. And it starts with electing people who know you, who see you, who care about you.
The final weekend before Election Day, heavy hitters like former President Barack Obama are on the road. Obama spoke in Pennsylvania for Democratic U.S. Senate candidate John Fetterman.
Send me to D.C. And I'll be that 51st vote to eliminate the filibuster.
Lieutenant Governor Fetterman says filibuster reform would let Democrats protect abortion access and voting rights. But he's in a tight race with Republican celebrity doctor and patent medicine pitchman Mehmet Oz.
I believe we're the land of opportunity. I believe we can have a budget that works without recklessly spending our kids' money. I believe we can have an all-of-the-above energy policy.
Oz rally Saturday was headlined by former President Donald Trump, who again implied he'll run in 2024.
I promise you, in the very next very, very, very short period of time, you're going to be so happy. Okay.
The Republican National Committee chair Sunday told CNN that if Trump does run, they can't pay the legal bills in his numerous criminal and civil cases. But the former president might run just to support his claim that the investigations are politically motivated. In Georgia, Democratic Senator Raphael Warnock has an edge over his Republican challenger, the retired football player Herschel Walker. That state's Republican Governor Brian Kemp has a distinct lead over challenger Stacey Abrams, but the Democrat is not giving up hope.
2.5 million votes cast. That is more than we've seen in a midterm ever. But, well, I love y'all too, but I need y'all to love us a little bit more because we got more work to do.
In Arizona, the FBI is investigating a white powder mailed to Republican candidate for governor Carrie Lake's headquarters. Lake says her staff regularly faces threats.
4-inch screws drilled into our tires so that our tires would blow out on the road after events. We're living in dangerous times.
Lake has a polling lead over Democratic Secretary of State Katie Hobbs, whose campaign office was burglarized a couple of weeks ago. The latest national generic congressional polls show Republicans with a narrow lead. The New York Times reports foreign actors are again trying to stoke political division here. Cybersecurity firms say Russian bots are promoting disinformation and saying the U.S. is wasting money by supporting Ukraine. Twitter may delay charging for verified accounts until after the midterms. New CEO Elon Musk says the $8 monthly charge will help fight spam and improve content.
If your payment verified with a blue checkmark, then you'll be prioritized.
Several civil rights organizations are calling on advertisers to boycott Twitter over concerns about rising anti-Semitism and hate. I'm Mary Sherman for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find RE Trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
Abortion is on the ballot in places across the country this election day. Proposal 3 on the Michigan ballot this week, if passed, would codify a woman's access to reproductive services, blocking implementation of a 1931 law that makes abortion a felony. A new report finds that losing access to reproductive rights would profoundly affect the economic security of individual women, their families, and their communities. Mark Richardson has more on that story.
The debate surrounding abortion often turns on emotional and moral issues, but a Michigan-based policy institute says the economic impact of overturning Roe v. Wade affects the largest number of women. Ahead of this week's vote on Proposal 3 to restore access to abortion, a Michigan League for Public Policy study reports that losing access to reproductive rights would profoundly affect the economic security of individual women, their families, and their communities. Ann Kunin, a policy analyst with the League and author of the report, says abortion rights affect more than just a few women.
In Michigan, 1 in 6 pregnancies ends in an abortion, which really highlights why this issue is so important, because this is clearly health care that pregnant people need and are relying on.
Proposal 3 would block the implementation of a 1931 Michigan law, still on the books, that makes most abortions a felony. Opponents claim the referendum would repeal current parental consent laws and allow minors to go through gender-affirming treatments without their parents' consent. Kunin says the research shows that a loss of access to abortion care would have an outsized effect on marginalized communities.
Black and Latino women especially are overrepresented in some of the lowest paying fields, like childcare, low-wage healthcare jobs. So the negative effects of being unable to access these essential healthcare services are really amplified for women of color.
Kunin says the social and economic well-being of children is directly linked to a mother's economic status. Research shows children of women denied abortions are more likely to grow up in poverty and more likely to experience poor maternal bonding, which can affect social and cognitive development.
The vast majority of Michiganders are paying out of pocket for their abortion. And for someone who's earning minimum wage in Michigan, that's basically your entire paycheck for 2 weeks.
For Michigan News Connection, I'm Mark Richardson.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for a special rebroadcast of our interviews with Portland City Commission candidates Renee Gonzalez and Joanne Hardesty. At 6 p.m., it's Labor Radio. Then at 6:30, Prison Pipeline. And at 7 p.m., let's talk about race. Your weather forecast for tonight is going to be chilly. We'll be cloudy, too, with a low of 36 degrees. Tomorrow's weather, maybe not quite as wet as today. Partly sunny with a high of 48 on Election Day. Today in history, it was this date in 1916 when Jeanette Rankin became the first woman elected to the U.S. Congress. While in Congress, she introduced legislation that eventually became the 19th Amendment, granting women the right to vote. As of this year, Rankin is still the only woman ever elected to Congress from Montana. The quote of the day is from Polish-French scientist Marie Curie, who was born today in 1867. Dr. Curie said, "Nothing in life is to be feared. It is only to be understood. Now is the time to understand more so that we may fear less." Alaska and the rest of the U.S. brace for the outcome of crucial midterm elections as advocates work to mobilize the Alaska Native vote. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Get out the Native vote efforts continue in Alaska ahead of Election Day. A voting advocate with a nonpartisan group to mobilize Alaska Native and American Indian voters says ballots going to and from remote communities will likely travel on small planes. That's why Michelle Spark with Get Out the Native Vote has been working with the Alaska Air Carriers Association to raise awareness about what she calls precious cargo. Spark says it's important for pilots and airline agents to recognize the packaging for election materials so ballots don't get pushed aside for other air freight.
Let's make sure all the players are engaged and involved and that we're all prepared to make sure that our villages and our Native communities can vote with ease.
Spark works with people like Donna Folger of Tanana, a village in interior Alaska, to raise awareness of voting. Folger plans on cooking breakfast near the polling site as an incentive to get people to vote.
They get to have a cup of coffee and pancakes, scrambled eggs, bacon or spam.
In other areas, like in western Alaska, one group of tribes is offering other incentives. The United Tribes of Bristol Bay plans to distribute a total of $20,000 to communities with the highest turnout. The money will go to schools and cultural programs. The Navajo Times reports Navajo Nation Council Speaker Seth Damon resigned Friday during a special council session. This comes after a photo surfaced of him allegedly intoxicated during a recent trip to Las Vegas. The photo shows Damon slumped over at a casino. Damon calls the photo unauthorized and admitted to the council that he was intoxicated, saying he was on a family vacation to support Navajo athletes at a national rodeo event and was not on official Navajo business. He was in his second term as speaker. The Navajo Times reports Damon is running unopposed for the seat in the November 8th election to serve a third term and is likely to be reelected. He is reportedly going to rehab. Meanwhile, President Joe Biden has appointed Navajo Nation First Lady Fafili Yanez to serve as a board member for the John F. Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts in Washington, D.C. As Arizona Public Radio's Ryan Heinches reports, it's in recognition of her broad support of indigenous communities.
Nez is a longtime advocate for education, the arts, and the retention of Navajo language and culture. She was raised on Hopi partition land in Big Mountain, Arizona, in a traditional hogan. Nez holds an honorary doctorate in humane letters from Northern Arizona University, and for 15 years has served on various boards, task forces, and commissions. According to the White House, as First Lady, she's been an advocate for restoring and strengthening homes and families. In a statement, Nez says she's humbled to join the Kennedy Center's Board of Trustees, and that performing arts are essential to the well-being and health of all communities. Nez was among seven appointees made by President Biden last month. They include business people, philanthropists, government officials, and others. The board provides guidance for the organization that hosts upwards of 2,000 performances a year and is the home of the National Symphony Orchestra and the Washington National Opera. It's also a living memorial to President John F. Kennedy, who was instrumental in the center's creation. For National Native News, I'm Ryan Heinches in Flagstaff, Arizona.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Efforts to restore bison, also known as buffalo, on the Wind River Indian Reservation in central Wyoming could hold the key to strengthening ecosystems and economies across western states. The Eastern Shoshone, historically known as buffalo eaters, also see reintroduction as critical for preserving cultural heritage and improving tribal health and wellness. Eric Galitas has more.
Some 50 million bison roaming across the Great Plains once served as the backbone for thriving Western economies before European settlers slaughtered herds to the brink of extinction. Eastern Shoshone tribal member Jason Baldus is working to bring buffalo back onto tribal lands to roam freely, starting with a small herd on the Wind River Indian Reservation in central Wyoming. He says restoring a wildlife economy will require a shift in vision for land management away from the status quo driven exclusively by dollars.
For Native people, a healthy environment is much more valuable. And so as we restore bison to the landscape for their keystone role as an ecosystem engineer, then we're restoring the land and we're thinking more about biodiversity and the interconnectedness of all these beings that are here.
Unlike grazing cattle that decrease plant and animal biodiversity critical for ecosystems, Baldus notes bison increase biodiversity by creating food and habitat for hundreds of species. Their dust bathing creates micro-depressions, important for seed dispersal and water accumulation. Their hooves naturally aerate the soil. Every winter, they put on a new coat, which becomes available for many species of birds when they shed in the spring. For thousands of years before America's first residents were stripped of their lands and food supplies, the health and wealth of Native communities in the region was directly connected to bison. Baldus says despite being separated for 130 years, the animal is still very present in cultural belief systems, including their annual sundance.
It's in our sweat lodge ceremonies. It's in our house ceremonies. We still have songs about the buffalo. That animal historically was our life's commissary. It was our store. It was where our foods, our medicines, our tools, our material came from.
The Eastern Band of Shoshone were also widely renowned as buffalo eaters, and Baldus says bringing herds back to western lands managed as wild animals will also help tribes heal.
We have the highest rates of diabetes and heart disease and other health-related issues because of the removal of buffalo from our diet. So incorporating that back into our diet again is very important. It's the highest in protein, minerals, and vitamins, and the lowest in fat and cholesterol than any other meat.
This is Eric Galatis reporting for the Wyoming News Service.
The United Nations Climate Change Conference, COP27, is happening now in Egypt. Advocates say the adverse effects of climate change are already being felt around the U.S., and Tuesday's election will have a major impact. Roz Brown has more in New Mexico.
New Mexico's dwindling water supply is just one issue caused by the climate crisis, with the drought-stricken Colorado River Basin creating problems for seven southwestern states. Water resource management is one of many issues being discussed at the annual United Nations Climate Change Conference, known as COP27, underway in Egypt. League of Women Voters New Mexico Representative Kathleen Burke of Albuquerque says the conference was first held in 1995 and hoped for results still are elusive.
As the consequences become more dire, minute by minute, day by day on this planet, it becomes all the more important that we continue to try to get world leadership to take the steps that need to be taken.
One agreement already considered a breakthrough is a willingness to discuss the financing of damages caused by increasingly extreme weather events. Previously, a sticking point between rich and poor nations, which are disproportionately affected by climate change. COP27 continues through November 18th. While attending the conference, Burke will promote research of a Santa Fe scientist on the imminent dangers of microwave radiation to life on Earth. She believes an all-hands-on-deck mentality is needed for humanity to tackle the new climate reality.
We know that even if we all stop driving our cars and creating other forms of pollution today, we're still going to be in a bad way to save what we all know as nature.
President Joe Biden will attend the COP27 conference, touting passage of the Inflation Reduction Act, which includes hundreds of billions of dollars for clean energy initiatives. A group of 16 Democrats is urging Biden to support a non-binding global memorandum that sets a target for 30% of all new medium and heavy-duty vehicles to be zero emission by 2030. This is Roz Brown, New Mexico News Connection.
The ramifications of climate change are being felt with regards to energy as well. Climate change could dry up hydropower in some regions. However, other areas are expected to see increased hydropower capacity as precipitation increases. Dr. Anthony Leisowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Leisowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Building more hydroelectric power plants can help the world transition away from coal and natural gas, and hydropower can provide electricity when wind and solar are not available. But Paulina Aramillo of Carnegie Mellon University says hydropower is vulnerable to climate-driven changes in rainfall and water supplies. For example, in some places like the southwestern U.S., severe droughts are leaving less water available for hydropower. In time, water shortages may also affect regions where glaciers currently provide water.
If glaciers fully melt, then those systems won't have enough water.
But Aramia's research shows that other areas, like many parts of East Africa, will have more precipitation and more potential hydropower capacity. So she says building new plants and interconnecting the grid can help get hydropower from where it's abundant to where it's needed. That's no easy task. New plants are expensive. Dams and reservoirs can harm the environment, and building transmission lines can be difficult.
But there's still a lot of hydropower capacity around the world.
So she hopes her research can be used to help increase the use of hydropower in a way that minimizes its vulnerabilities to climate change.
You're listening to the KABU Evening News for Monday, November 7th, 2022. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Josh Salem, the producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Antonia Gonzalez, Roz Brown, Mark Richardson, Eric Galatas, Mary Sherman, and Dr. Anthony Lizowitz. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Michelle Coppola. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 8 a.m., it's Too Much Information with Abe and Tracy, following politics and history and taking listener calls. At 9, Alternative Radio features lectures and interviews with progressive thinkers. And at 10, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. Then at 11 a.m., it's Art Focus. Host Joseph Gallivan interviews curator Kathleen Ash Milde about the exhibit Dakota Modern, The Art of Oscar Howe, on right now at the Portland Art Museum. Plus, tune in to KBOO tomorrow night at 6 p.m. for our live election coverage. All of these KBOO programs, including the evening news, are made possible by support from our members, great folks like you. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or use our mobile app and click on Donate. Thanks for listening and have a great night.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You are listening to KBOO News In Depth. Today, we'll hear two interviews I conducted with the two candidates for Portland City Commissioner Position 3, Renee Gonzalez and Commissioner Joanne Hardesty. First, I spoke with Renee Gonzalez. Gonzalez comes from the private sector, opening a law firm in 2012, serving as a managing partner for that firm and a subsidiary software company. Gonzalez also helped build the largest youth soccer club in Portland and served the Children's Museum and the Library Foundation. Now here is my conversation with candidate Renee Gonzalez. So thanks for taking the time to talk with KBOO today. You're challenging Portland City Commissioner Joanne Hardesty for the Position 3 seat. When you reflect on the campaign so far, are there things you wish you could change, things you wish you could do differently?
Oh, thanks so much for having me. You know, we're at a time of real intensity. And so any time that we've added fuel to the fire, you know, I wish we weren't and trying to calm things down.